her body a chance to digest the meal. It was good to be able to take her time, do things at a pace her body found comfortable. Eventually, she became herself, small and black, young and female. Kane would not like it, but that did not matter. The stranger would like it very much. She put on one of her best dresses and a few pieces of good jewelry, brushed her glossy new crown of hair, and went downstairs. Supper had just been finished without her. Her people never waited for her when they knew she was in one or another of her animal forms. They knew her leisurely habits. Now, several of her adult children, Kane and Leah, and the black stranger, sat eating nuts and raisins, drinking wine, and talking quietly. They made room for her, breaking their conversation for greeting and welcome. One of her sons got her a glass and filled it with her favorite Madeira. She had taken only a single pleasant sip from it when the stranger said, "The sea has done you good. You were right to go." Her shoulders drooped slightly, though she managed not to change expression. It was only Doro. He caught her eye and smiled, and she knew he had seen her disappointment, had no doubt planned her disappointment. She contrived to ignore him, looked around the table to see exactly who was present. "Where is Louisa?" she asked. The old woman often took supper with the family, feeding her foster children first, then coming in, as she said, to relearn adult conversation. But now, at the mention of Louisa's name, everyone fell silent. The son next to her, Julian, who had poured her wine, said softly, "She died, Mama." Anyanwu turned to look at him, yellow-brown and plain, except for his eyes, utterly clear like her own. Years before, when a woman he wanted desperately would have nothing to do with him, he had gone to Louisa for comfort. Louisa had told Anyanwu, and Anyanwu had been amazed to find that she felt no resentment toward the old woman, no anger at Julian for taking his pain to a stranger. With her sensitivity, Louisa had ceased to be a stranger the day she arrived on the plantation.
"How did she die?"
Anyanwu whispered finally.
"In a sleep," Julian said. "She went to bed one night, and the next morning, the children couldn't wake her up."
"That was 2 weeks ago,"
Leah said.
"We got the priest to come out because we knew she'd want it. We gave her a fine funeral."
Leah hesitated.
She didn't have any pain. I lay down on her bed to see, and I saw her go out just as easy."
Anyanwu got up and left the table. She had gone away to find some respite from loved ones who died and died, and others whose rapid aging reminded her that they too were temporary. Leah, only 35, had far too much gray mixed with her straight black hair. Anyanwu went into the library, closed the door. Closed doors were respected in her house, and sat at her desk, head down.
Louisa had been 78 years old.
It was time for her to die. How stupid to grieve over an old woman who lived what, for her kind, was a long life. Anyanwu sat up and shook her head. She had been watching friends and relatives grow old and die for as long as she could remember. Why was it biting so deeply into her now, hurting her as though it were a new thing? Stephen, Margaret, Louisa. There would be others. There would always be others, suddenly here, then suddenly gone. Only she would remain. As though to contradict her thought, Doro opened the door and came in. She glared at him angrily. Everyone else in her house respected her closed doors, but then Doro respected nothing at all.
"What do you want?"
she asked him.
"Nothing."
He pulled a chair over to the side of her desk and sat down.
"What? No more children for me to raise?"
she said bitterly.
"No more unsuitable mates for my children? Nothing?"
I brought a pregnant woman and her two children, and I brought an account at a New Orleans bank to help pay their way. I didn't come to you to talk about them, though.
Anyanwu turned away from him, not caring why he had come. She wished he would leave.
It goes on, you know, he said. The dying.
It doesn't hurt you.
It does. When my children die, the best of my children.
What do you do?
Endure it. What is there to do but endure it? Someday, we'll have others who won't die.
Are you still dreaming that dream?
What could I do, Anyanwu, if I gave it up?
She said nothing. She had no answer.
I used to believe in it, too, she said. When you took me from my people, I believed it. For 50 years, I made myself believe it. Perhaps sometimes I still believe it.
You never behaved as though you believed it.
I did. I let you do all the things you did to me and to others, and I stayed with you until I could see you had decided to kill me.
He drew a deep breath.
That decision was a mistake, he said. I made it out of habit, as though you were just another, not entirely controllable, wild seed woman who had had her quota of children. Centuries-old habit said it was time to dispose of you.
And what of your habit now?
She asked.
It's broken now, as far as you're concerned.
He looked at her, looked past her.
I want you alive for as long as you can live. You cannot know how I have fought with myself over this.
She did not care how he had fought.
I tried hard to make myself kill you, he said. It would have been easier than trying to change you.
She shrugged. He stood up and took her arms to raise her to her feet. She stood passively, knowing that if she let him have his way, they would wind up on the sofa together. He wanted her. He did not care that she had just suffered the loss of a friend, that she wanted to be alone.
"Do you like this body?" he asked. "It's my gift to you."
She wondered who had died so that he could give such a gift.
"Anyanwu."
He shook her once, gently, and she looked at him. She did not have to look up.
You're still the little forest peasant trying to climb the ship's railings and swim back to Africa, he said. You still want what you can't have. The old woman is dead.
Again, she only shrugged.
They'll all die, except me, he continued. Because of me, you are not alone on the ship. Because of me, you will never be alone.
He took her to the sofa, finally, undressed her, made love to her. She found that she did not mind particularly. The lovemaking relaxed her, and when it was over, she escaped easily into sleep. Not much time had passed when he woke her. The sunlight and the long shadows told her it was still evening. She wondered why he had not left her. He had what he wanted, and intentionally or not, he had given her peace. Now if only he would go away. Anyanwu looked at him seated beside her, half-dressed, still shirtless. They were not crowded together on the large sofa as they would have been had he been wearing one of his usual large bodies. Again, she wondered about the original owner of his beautiful, unlikely, new body, but she asked no questions. She did not want to learn that it had been one of her descendants. He caressed her silently for a moment, and she thought he meant to resume the lovemaking. She sighed and decided that it did not matter. So little seemed to matter now.
I'm going to try something with you, he said. I've wanted to do it for years. Before you ran away, I assumed I would do it someday. Now everything has changed, but I mean to have some of this anyway.
Some of what?
She said wearily.
What are you talking about?
I can't explain, he said. But look at me, Anyanwu. Look! She turned onto her side, faced him.
I won't hurt you, he said. Hear and see whatever it is that helps you know I'm being honest with you. I won't hurt you. You'll be in danger only if you disobey me. This body of mine is strong and young and new to me. My control is excellent. Obey me, and you will be safe.
She lay flat again.
Tell me what you want, Doro. What shall I do for you now?
To her surprise, he smiled and kissed her.
Just lie still and trust me. Believe that I mean you no harm.
She did believe, though at the moment she barely cared. How ironic that now he was beginning to care, beginning to see her as more than only another of his breeding animals. She nodded and felt his hands grip her. Abruptly, she was in darkness, falling through darkness toward distant light, falling. She felt herself twisting, writhing, grasping for some support. She screamed in reflexive terror and could not hear her own voice. Instantly, the darkness around her vanished. She was on the sofa again, with Doro gasping beside her. There were bloody nail marks on his chest, and he was massaging his throat as though it hurt. She was concerned in spite of herself.
Doro, have I hurt your throat?
He took a deep, ragged breath.
Not much. I was ready for you, or I thought I was.
What did you do? It was like the kind of dream children wake screaming from.
Alter your hands, he said.
What?
Obey me. Make claws of your hands.
With a shrug, she formed powerful leopard claws.
Good, Doro said.
I didn't even weaken you.
My control is as steady as I thought. Now change back.
He fingered his throat lightly.
I wouldn't want you going at me with those.
Again she obeyed. She was behaving like one of his daughters, doing things she did not understand unquestioningly because he commanded it. That thought roused her to question.
Doro, what are we doing?
Do you see? He said. That the thing you felt has not harmed you in any way?
But what was it?
Wait, Anyanwu. Trust me. I'll explain all I can later. I promise you. For now, relax. I'm gonna do it again.
No,
it won't hurt you. It will be as though you were in midair under Isaac's control. He would never have hurt you. I won't either.
He had begun stroking and caressing her again, trying to calm her. And succeeding. She had not really been hurt, after all.
Be still, he whispered. Let me have this, Anyanwu.
It will please you somehow? As though we were making love?
Even more.
All right.
She wondered what she was saying all right to. It had nothing to do with Isaac's tossing her into the air and catching her with that gentle, sure ability of his. This was nightmare stuff, helpless, endless falling. But it was not real. She had not fallen. She was not injured. Finally, Doro wanted something of her that would not hurt anyone. Perhaps if she gave it to him and survived, she would gain leverage with him, be better able to protect her people from him. Let them live their brief lives in peace.
Don't fight me this time, he said. I'm no match for you in physical strength. You know that. Now that you know what to expect, you can be still and let it happen. Trust me.
She lay watching him, quiescent, waiting.
All right,
she repeated. He moved closer to her, put his arm around her so that her head was pillowed on it.
I like contact,
he said, explaining nothing.
It's never as good without contact.
She glanced at him, then made herself comfortable with her body and his touching along their length.
Now,
he said softly. There was the darkness again, the feeling of falling, but after a moment it seemed more like drifting slowly, only drifting. She was not afraid. She felt warm and at ease and not alone, yet it seemed that she was alone. There was a light far ahead of her, but nothing else, no one else. She was drifting toward the light, watching it grow as she moved nearer. It was a distant star at first, faint and flickering. Eventually, it was the morning star, bright, dominating her otherwise empty sky. Gradually, the light became a sun, filling her sky with brightness that should have blinded her. But she was not blinded, not uncomfortable in any way. She could feel Doro near her, though she was no longer aware of his body or even her own body lying on the sofa. This was another kind of awareness, a kind she had no words to describe. It was good, pleasurable. He was with her. If he had not been, she would have been utterly alone. What had he said before the lovemaking, before the relaxed, easy sleep? That because of him, she would never be alone. The words had not comforted her then, but they comforted her now. The sun's light enveloped her, and there was no darkness anywhere. In a sense now, she was blind. There was nothing to see except blazing light. But still, there was no discomfort. And there was Doro with her, touching her as no one had touched her before. It was as though he touched her spirit, enfolding it within himself, spreading the sensation of his touch through every part of her. She became aware slowly of his hunger for her, literal hunger. But instead of frightening her, it awakened a strange sympathy in her. She felt not only his hunger, but his restraint and his loneliness. The loneliness formed a kinship between them. He had been alone for so long, so impossibly long. Her own loneliness, her own long life, seemed insignificant. She was like a child beside him, but child or not, he needed her. He needed her as he had never needed anyone else. She reached out to touch him, hold him, ease his long, long solitude, or she seemed to reach. She did not know what he did nor what she actually did, but it was startlingly good. It was a blending that went on and on, a joining that it seemed to Anyanwu she controlled. Not until she rested, pleasantly weary, did she begin to realize she was losing herself. It seemed that his restraint had not held. The joining they had enjoyed was not enough for him. He was absorbing her, consuming her, making her part of his own substance. He was the great light, the fire that had englobed her. Now he was killing her, little by little, digesting her, little by little. In spite of all his talk, he was betraying her. In spite of all the joy they had just given each other, he could not forgo the kill. In spite of the new higher value he had tried to place on her, breeding and killing were still all that had meaning to him.
Well then, so be it. So be it. She was tired.
Chapter 14. With meticulous care, Doro disentangled himself from Anyanwu. It was much easier than he had thought it would be, stopping in the middle of what could have been an intensely satisfying kill. But he had never intended to kill. He had gone further with her, though, than he did with the most powerful of his children. With them, he forced the potentially deadly contact to enable him to understand the limits of their power, understand whether that power could ever in any way threaten him. He did it soon after their transitions, so that he found them physically depleted, emotionally weary, and too ignorant of their newly matured abilities to even begin to understand how to fight him, if they could fight him. Very rarely, he found someone who could, and that person died. He wanted allies, not rivals. But he had not been testing on Yanwu. He knew she could not threaten him. Knew he could kill her as long as she was in human form. He had never doubted it. She did not have the kinds of thought-reading and thought-controlling abilities that he considered potentially dangerous. He destroyed anyone who showed the potential, the strength to someday read or control his thoughts. Anyanwu had almost absolute control of every cell of her malleable body, but her mind was as open and defenseless as the mind of any ordinary person, which meant she would eventually have trouble with the people he was bringing her. They would marry into her large family and cause dissension. He had warned her of that. Eventually, she would have children and grandchildren here who were more like Joseph and Lael than like the congenial, weakly sensitive people she had collected around her. But that was another matter. He could think about it later. Now, all that was important was that she revive whole and well. Nothing must happen to her. No amount of anger or stupidity on her part, or his, must induce him to think again of killing her. She was too valuable, in too many ways. She awoke slowly, opening her eyes, looking around to find the library in darkness, except for the fire he had made in the fireplace, and a single lamp on the table at her head. He lay close beside her, warming himself by her warmth. He wanted her close to him.
"Doro,"
she whispered. He kissed her cheek and relaxed. She was all right. She had been so completely passive in her grief. He had been certain he could do this to her and not harm her. He had been certain that this once she would not resist and make him hurt or kill her.
"I was dying," she said.
"No, you weren't."
"I was dying. You were..."
He put his hand over her mouth, then let her move it away when he saw that she would be still.
"I had to know you that way at least once," he said. "I had to touch you that way."
"Why?"
she asked.
"Because it's the closest I'll ever come to you."
She did not respond to that for a long while. Eventually, though, she moved her head to rest it on his chest. He could not remember when she had done that last on her own. He folded his arms over her, remembering that other, more complete enfolding. How had he ever had the control to stop, he wondered.
"Is it that way, that easy for all the others?"
she asked. He hesitated, not wanting to lie to her, not wanting to talk about his kills at all.
"Fear makes it worse for them," he said. "And they're always afraid. Also, I have no reason to be gentle with them."
"Do you hurt them? Is there pain?"
"No. I feel what they feel, so I know. They don't feel pain any more than you did."
"It was good,"
she said with wonder.
"Until I thought you would kill me, it was so good."
He could only hold her and press his face into her hair.
"We should go upstairs," she said.
"Soon."
"What shall I do?"
she asked.
"I have fought you all these years. My reasons for fighting you still exist. What shall I do?"
"What Isaac wanted. What do you want? Join with me. What's the good of fighting me? Especially now."
"Now."
She was still, perhaps savoring their brief contact. He hoped she was. He was. He wondered what she would say if he told her no one had ever before enjoyed such contact with him. No one in nearly 4,000 years. His people found contact with him terrifying. Thought readers and controllers who survived such contact quickly learned that they could not read or control him without sacrificing their lives. They learned to pay attention to the vague wariness they felt of him as soon as their transitions ended. Occasionally, he found a man or woman he cared for, enjoyed repeated contact with. These endured what he did, since they could not prevent it, though their grim, long-suffering attitudes made him feel like a rapist. But Anyanwu had participated, had enjoyed, had even taken the initiative for a while, greatly intensifying his pleasure. He looked at her with wonder and delight. She looked back, solemnly.
"Nothing is solved," she said. "Except that now I must fight myself as well as you."
"You're talking foolishness," he said. She turned and kissed him.
"Let it be foolishness for now," she said. "Let it be foolishness for this moment."
She looked down at him in the dim light.
"You don't want to go upstairs, do you?"
"No."
"We'll stay here, then. My children will whisper about me."
"Do you care?"
"Now you are talking foolishness," she said, laughing. "Do I care? Whose house is this? I do as I please."
She covered them both with the wide skirt of her dress, blew out the lamp, and settled to sleep in his arms. Anyanwu's children did whisper about her, and about Doro. They were careless, deliberately so, Doro thought. And he heard them. But after a while, they stopped. Perhaps Anyanwu spoke to them. For once, Doro did not care. He knew he was no longer fearsome to them. He was only another of Anyanwu's lovers. How long had it been since he was only someone's lover? He could not remember. He went away now and then to take care of his businesses, put in an appearance at one of his nearer settlements.
"Bring this body back to me as long as you can,"
Anyanwu would tell him.
"There cannot be two as perfect as this."
He would laugh and promise her nothing. Who knew what punishment he might have to inflict, what madman he might have to subdue, what stupid, stubborn politician, businessman, planter, or other fool he might have to remove. Also, wearing a black body in country where blacks were under constant obligation to prove they had rights to even limited freedom was a hindrance. He traveled with one of his older white sons, Frank Winston, whose fine old Virginia family had belonged to Doro since Doro brought it from England 135 years before. The man could be as distinguished and aristocratic, or as timid and naive, as he chose to be, as Doro ordered him to be. He had no inborn strangeness great enough to qualify him as good breeding stock. He was simply the best actor, the best liar, Doro knew. People believed what he told them, even when he grew expansive and outrageous. When he said Doro was an African prince mistakenly enslaved, but now freed to return to his homeland and take the word of God back to his heathen people. Though caught by surprise, Doro played his role with such a confusing mixture of arrogance and humility that slaveholders were first caught between bewilderment and anger, then convinced. Doro was like no nigger they had ever seen. Later, Doro warned Frank to stick to more conventional lies, though he thought the man was probably laughing too hard to hear him. He felt more at ease than he had for years, even at ease enough to laugh at himself, and his son enjoyed traveling with him. It was worth the inconvenience to keep Anyanwu happy. He knew that a kind of honeymoon phase of their relationship would end when he had to give up the body that pleased her so. She would not turn away from him again, he was certain, but their relationship would change. They would become occasional mates, as they had been in Wheatley, but with better feelings. She would welcome him now, in whichever body he wore. She would have her men, and if she chose, her women, husbands, wives, lovers. He could not begrudge her these. There would be years, multiples of years, when he would not see her at all. A woman like her could not be alone. But there would always be room for him when he came back to her, and he would always go back to her. Because of her, he was no longer alone. Because of her, life was suddenly better than it had been for him in centuries, in millennia. It was as though she was the first of the race he was trying to create, except that he had not created her, had not been able to recreate her. In that way, she was only a promise unfulfilled. But someday... Doro's woman, Susan, had her child a month after Iye bore Stephen's child. Both were boys, sturdy and healthy, promising to grow into handsome children. Iye accepted her son with love and gratitude that amazed Anyanwu. Anyanwu had delivered the child, and all Iye could think of through her pain was that Stephen's child must live and be well. It had not been an easy birth, but the woman clearly did not care. The child was all right. But Iye could not feed it. She had no milk. Anyanwu produced milk easily and during the day visited Iye's cabin regularly to nurse the child. At night, she kept the child with her.
"I'm glad you could do this," Iye told her. "I think it would be too hard for me to share him with anyone else."
Anyanwu's prejudices against the woman were fast dissolving. As were her prejudices against Doro, though this frightened and disturbed her. She could not look at him now with the loathing she had once felt, yet he continued to do loathsome things. He simply no longer did them to her. As she had predicted, she was at war with herself. But she showed him no signs of that war. For the time he wore the beautiful little body that had been his gift to her, it pleased her to please him. For that short time, she could refuse to think about what he did when he left her. She could treat him as the very special lover he appeared to be.
"What are you going to do now?"
Doro asked her when he came home from a short trip to find her nursing the baby.
"Push me away?"
They were alone in her upstairs sitting room, so she gave him a look of mock annoyance.
"Shall I do that?" "Yes, I think so. Go away."
He smiled, not believing her any more than she wished to be believed. He watched the nursing child.
"You will be a father to one like this in 7 months more," she said.
"You're pregnant now?"
"Yes. I wanted a child by this body of yours. I was afraid you would be getting rid of it soon."
"I will be," he admitted. "I'll have to. But eventually you'll have 2 children to nurse. Won't that be hard on you?"
"I can do it. Do you think I can't?"
"No."
He smiled again.
"If only I had more like you and Iye. That Susan..."
"I found a home for her child," Anyanwu said. "It won't be fostered with the older ones, but it will have loving parents. And Susan is big and strong. She's a fine field hand."
"I didn't bring her here to be a field hand. I thought living with your people might help her, calm her and make her a little more useful."
"It has."
She reached over and took his hand.
"Here, if people fit in, I let them do whatever work they prefer. That helps to calm them. Susan prefers field work to anything indoors. She is willing to have as many more children as you want, but caring for them is beyond her. She seems especially sensitive to their thoughts. Their thoughts hurt her somehow. She is a good woman otherwise, Doro."
Doro shook his head as though dismissing Susan from his thoughts. He stared at the nursing child for a few seconds more, then met Anyanwu's eyes.
"Give me some of the milk,"
he said softly. She drew back in surprise. He had never asked such a thing, and this was certainly not the first child he had seen her nursing. But there were many new things between them now.
"I had a man who used to do that,"
she said. "Did you mind?"
"No."
He looked at her, waiting.
"Come here,"
she said softly. The day after Anyanwu gave him milk, Doro awoke, trembling, and he knew the comfortable time in the compact little body he had taken as a gift to her was over. It had not been a particularly powerful body. It had little of the inborn strangeness he valued. Anyanwu's child by it might be beautiful, but chances were it would be very ordinary. Now the body was used up. If he held on to it for much longer, he would become dangerous to those around him. Some simple excitement or pain that he would hardly notice normally might force transmigration. Someone whose life was important to him might die. He looked over at Anyanwu, still asleep beside him, and sighed. What had she said that night months before? That nothing had really changed? They had finally accepted each other. They would keep each other from loneliness now. But beyond that, she was right. Nothing had changed. She would not want him near her for a while after he had changed. She would still refuse to understand that whether he killed out of need, accident, or choice, he had to kill. There was no way for him to avoid it. An ordinary human might be able to starve himself to death, but Doro could not. Better, then, to make a controlled kill than to just let himself go until he did not know who he would take. How many lifetimes would pass before Anyanwu understood that? She awoke beside him.
"Are you getting up?"
she asked.
"Yes, but there is no reason for you to. It's not even dawn."
"Are you going away? You just come back."
He kissed her.
"Perhaps I'll come back again in a few days."
To see how she reacted, to be certain that nothing had changed, or perhaps in the hope that they were both wrong, that she had grown a little.
"Stay a little longer,"
she whispered.
She knew.
"I can't," he said. She was silent for a moment. Then she sighed.
"You are asleep when I fed the child,"
she said.
"But there is still milk for you if you want it."
At once, he lowered his head to her breast. Probably there would not be any more of this either. Not for a long while. Her milk was rich and good and as sweet as this time with her had been. Now, for a while, they would begin the old tug of war again. She stroked his head, and he sighed. Afterward, he went out and took Susan. She was the kind of kill he needed now, very sensitive. As sweet and good to his mind as Anyanwu's milk had been to his former body. He woke Frank, and together they hauled his former body to the old slave graveyard. He did not want one of Anyanwu's people to find it and go running to Anyanwu. She would know what had happened without that. If it were possible, he wanted to make this time easy for her. By the time he and Frank left, a whole gang of field hands was trooping out toward the cotton fields.
"Are you going to be wearing that body long?"
Frank asked him, looking at Susan's tall, stocky profile.
"No, I've already got what I need from it,"
Doro said.
"It's a good body, though. It could last a year, maybe two."
"But it wouldn't do Anyanwu much good."
"It might if it were anyone but Susan. Anyanwu's had wives after all, but she knew Susan, liked her. Except in emergencies, I don't ask people to overcome feelings like that."
"You and Anyanwu," Frank muttered. "Changing sex, changing color, breeding like—"
"Shut your mouth,"
Doro said in annoyance.
or I'll tell you a few things you don't want to hear about your own family."
Startled, Frank fell silent. He was sensitive about his ancestry, his old Virginia family. For some foolish reason, it was important to him. Doro caught himself as he was about to destroy completely any illusions the man still had about his blue blood, or for that matter, his pure white skin. But there was no reason for Doro to do such a thing. No reason except that one of the best times he could remember was ending, and he was not certain what would come next. 2 weeks later, when he went back to Anyanwu, home to Anyanwu, he was alone. He had sent Frank home to his family and put on the more convenient body of a lean, brown-haired white man. It was a good, strong body, but Doro knew better than to expect Anyanwu to appreciate it. She said nothing when she saw him. She did not accuse him or curse him, did not seem hostile to him at all. On the other hand, she was hardly welcoming. "You did take Susan, didn't you?" was all she said. When he said yes, she turned and walked away. He thought that if she had not been pregnant, she would have gone to sea and left him to deal with her not quite respectful children. She knew he would not harm them now. Pregnancy kept her in human form, however. She was carrying a human child. She would almost certainly kill it by taking a non-human form. She had told him that during one of her early pregnancies by Isaac, and he had counted it a weakness. He had no doubt that she could abort any pregnancy without help or danger to herself. She could do anything with that body of hers that she wished. But she would not abort. Once a child was inside her, it would be born. During all the years he had known her, she had been as careful with her children before they were born as afterward. Doro decided to stay with her during this period of weakness. Once she accepted his two most recent changes, he did not think he would have trouble with her again. It took him many long, uncommunicative days to find out how wrong he was. Finally, it was Anyanwu's young daughter, Helen, who made him understand. The girl sometimes seemed very much younger than her 12 years. She played with other children and fought with them and cried over trivial hurts. At other times, she was a woman wearing the body of a child. And she was very much her mother's daughter.
"She won't talk to me,"
the child told Doro.
"She knows I know what she's gonna do."
She had come to sit beside him in the cool shade of a giant oak tree. For a time, they had watched in silence as Anyanwu weeded her herb garden. This garden was off-limits to other gardeners and to helpful children, both of whom considered a great many of Anyanwu's plants nothing but weeds themselves. Now, though, Doro looked away from the garden and at Helen.
"What do you mean?" he asked her. "What is she going to do?"
She looked up at him, and he had no doubt that a woman looked out of those eyes.
"She says Cain and Leah are going to come and live here. She says after the baby comes, she's going away."
"To see?"
"No, Doro, not to see. Someday she would have to come out of the sea. Then you would find her again, and she would have to watch you kill her friends. Kill your own friends."
"What are you talking about?"
He caught her by the arms, barely stopped himself from shaking her. She glared at him, furious, clearly loathing him. Suddenly, she lowered her head and bit his hand as hard as she could with her sharp little teeth. Pain made Doro release her. She could not know how dangerous it was for her to cause him sudden, unexpected pain. Had she done it just before he killed Susan, he would have taken her helplessly. But now, having fed recently, he had more control. He held his bloody hand and watched her run away. Then, slowly, he got up and went over to Anyanwu. She had dug up several purple-stemmed, yellow-rooted weeds. He expected her to throw them away, but instead she cut the plants from their rootstocks, brushed the dirt from the stalks, and put the stalks in her gathering basket.
What are those things?
He asked.
A medicine, she said. Or a poison, if people don't know what to do with it.
What are you going to do with it?
Powder it, mix it with some other things, steep it in boiling water, and give it to children who have worms.
Doro shook his head.
I think you could help them more easily by making the medicine within your own body.
This will work just as well. I'm going to teach some of the women to make it.
Why?
So that they can heal themselves and their families without depending on what they see as my magic.
He reached down and tipped her head up so that she faced him.
And why shouldn't they depend on your magic? Your medicines are more efficient than any ground weed.
She shrugged.
They should learn to help themselves.
He picked up her basket and drew her to her feet.
Come into the house and talk with me.
There is nothing to say.
Come in anyway. Humor me.
He put his arm around her and walked her back to the house. He started to take her into the library, but a group of the younger children were being taught to read there. They sat scattered in a half circle on the rug, looking up at one of Anyanwu's daughters. As Doro guided Anyanwu away from them, he could hear the voice of one of his sons by Susan reading a verse from the Bible.
Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits.
Doro glanced back.
That sounds as though it would be an unpopular scripture in this part of the country, he said.
I see to it that they learn some of the less popular ones, Anyanwu answered. There is another. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. They live in a world that does not want them to hear such things.
You're raising them as Christians, then?
She shrugged.
Most of their parents are Christian. They want their children to read so they can read the Bible. Besides,
she glanced at him, the corners of her mouth turned down.
Besides, this is a Christian country.
He ignored her sarcasm, took her into the back parlor.
Christians consider it a great sin to take one's own life, he said.
They consider it a sin to take any life, yet they kill and kill.
Anyanwu, why have you decided to die?
He would not have thought he could say the word so calmly. What would she think? That he did not care? Could she think that?
It's the only way I can leave you,
she said simply. He digested that for a moment.
I thought staying with you now would help you get used to the things I have to do, he said.
Do you think I'm not used to them?
You haven't accepted them. Why else should you want to die?
Because of what we have already said. Everything is temporary, but you and me. You are all I have, perhaps all I would ever have.
She shook her head slowly.
And you are an obscenity.
He frowned, staring at her. She had not said such things since their night together in the library. She had never said them this way, matter-of-factly, as though she were saying, "You are tall." He found that he could not even manufacture anger against her.
"Shall I go away?" he asked.
"No. Stay with me. I need you here."
"Even though I'm an obscenity?"
"Even so."
She was as she had been after Louisa's death, uncharacteristically passive, ready to die. Then it was loneliness and grief pressing on her, weighing her down then. Now. What was it now, really?
"Is it Susan?" he asked. "I didn't think you had gotten that close to her."
"I hadn't. But you had."
She gave you 3 children. But you did not need her life.
There was no other way she could be of use to me. She had had enough children, and she could not care for them. What did you expect me to do with her?
Anyanwu got up and walked out of the room. Later, he tried to talk to her again. She would not listen. She would not argue with him or curse him. When he offered again to go, she asked him to stay. When he came to her room at night, she was strangely, quietly welcoming. And she was still planning to die. There was an obscenity. An immortal, a woman who could live through the millennia with him. Yet she was intent on suicide, and he was not even certain why. He became more desperate as her pregnancy advanced, because he could not reach her, he could not touch her. She admitted she needed him, said she loved him, but some part of her was closed away from him, and nothing he said could reach it. Finally, he did go away for a few weeks. He did not like what she was doing to him. He could not remember a time when his thoughts had been so confused, when he had wanted so badly, so painfully, something he could not have. He had done what Anyanwu had apparently had done. He had allowed her to touch him as though he were an ordinary man. He had allowed her to awaken feelings in him that had been dormant for several times as long as even she had been alive. He had all but stripped himself before her. It amazed him that he could do such a thing, or that she could see him do it and not care. She, of all people. He went down to Baton Rouge to a woman he had once known. She was married now, but, as it happened, her husband was in Boston and she welcomed Doro. He stayed with her for a few days, always on the verge of telling her about Anyanwu, but never quite getting around to it. He took a new body, that of a free black who owned several slaves and treated them brutally. Afterward, he wondered why he had killed the man. It was no concern of his how a slaveholder treated his chattels. He shed the slaveholder body and took that of another free black, one who could have been a lighter-skinned brother to the one Anyanwu had liked, compact, handsome, red-brown. Perhaps she would reject it because it was too like the other one, without being the other one. Perhaps she would reject it because it was too unlike the other one. Who knew which way her mind would turn? But perhaps she would accept it and talk to him and close the distance between them before she shut herself off like used machinery. He went home to her. Her belly got in the way when he hugged her in greeting. On any other occasion, he would have laughed and stroked it, thinking of his child inside. Now he only looked at it, realized that she could give birth any time. How stupid he had been to go away and leave her, to give up any part of what might be their last days together. She took his hand and led him into the house while her son, Julian, took his horse. Julian gave Doro a long, frightened, pleading look that Doro did not acknowledge. Clearly, the man knew. Inside the house, he got the same kinds of looks from Leah and Kane, whom Anyanwu had sent for. Nobody said anything except an ordinary greeting, but the house was filled with tension. It was as though everyone felt it but Anyanwu. She seemed to feel nothing except solemn pleasure in having Doro home again. Supper was quiet, almost grim, and everyone seemed to have something to do to keep from lingering at the table. Everyone but Doro. He coaxed Anyanwu to share wine and fruit and nuts, and talk with him in the smaller, cooler back parlor. As it turned out, they shared wine and fruit and nuts, and silence. But it did not matter. It was enough that she was with him. Anyanwu's child, a tiny, sturdy boy, was born 2 weeks after Doro's return, and Doro became almost sick with desperation. He did not know how to deal with his feelings, could not recall ever having had such an intense confusion of feelings before. Sometimes he caught himself observing his own behavior, as though from a distance, and noticing with even greater confusion that there was nothing outwardly visible in him to show what he was suffering. He spent as much time as he could with Anyanwu, watching her prepare and mix her herbs, instruct several of her people at a time in their cultivation, appearance, and use, tend to those few who could not wait for this or that herb.
"What will they do when they only have the herbs?"
he asked her.
"Live or die as best they can," she said. "Everything truly alive dies sooner or later."
She found a woman to nurse her baby, and she gave calm instructions to a frightened Leah. She considered Leah the strangest and the brightest of her white daughters, and the one most competent to succeed her. Cain did not want this. He felt threatened, even frightened, by the thought of suddenly greater visibility. He would become more noticeable to people of his father's class, people who might have known his father. Doro thought this too unlikely to worry about. He found himself trying to explain to the man that if Cain played his role as well as Doro had always seen him play it, and if also he clearly possessed all the trappings of a wealthy planter, it would never occur to people to assume that he was anything but a wealthy planter. Doro told the story of Frank's passing him off as a Christianized African prince, and he and Cain laughed together over it. There had not been much laughter in the house recently, and even this ended abruptly.
"You have to stop her,"
Cain said, as though they had been discussing Anyanwu all along.
"You have to. You're the only one who can."
"I don't know what to do,"
Doro admitted bleakly. Cain would have no idea how unusual such an admission was from him.
"Talk to her. Does she want something? Give it to her."
"I think she wants me not to kill,"
Doro said. Cain blinked, then shook his head helplessly. Even he understood that it was impossible. Leah came into the back parlor where they were talking and stood before Doro, hands on her hips.
"I can't tell what you feel," she said. "I've never been able to somehow, but if you feel anything at all for her, go to her now."
"Why?"
Doro asked.
"Because she's gonna do it. She's just about gotten herself to the brink. I don't think she plans to wake up tomorrow morning, like Louisa."
Doro stood up to go, but Cain stopped him with a question to Leah.
"Honey, what does she want? What does she really want from him?"
Leah looked from one man to another, saw that they were both awaiting her answer.
"I asked her that myself," she said. "She just said she was tired, tired to death."
She had seemed weary, Doro thought, but weary of what? Him? She had begged him not to go away again, not that he had planned to.
"Tired of what?" he asked.
Leah held her hands in front of her and looked down at him. She opened and closed the fingers as though to grasp something, but she held only air. She gestured sometimes when receiving or remembering images and impressions no one else could see. In ordinary society, people would certainly have thought her demented.
"That's what I can feel," she said. "If I sit where she's recently sat, or even more if I handle something she's worn, it's a reaching and reaching and grasping, and then her hands are empty. There's nothing. She's so tired."
"Maybe it's just her age," Cain said. "Maybe it's finally caught up with her."
Leah shook her head.
"I don't think so. She's not in any pain, hasn't slowed down at all. She's just..."
Leah made a sound of frustration and distress, almost a sob.
"I'm no good at this," she said. "Things either come to me clear and sharp without my working and worrying at 'em, or they never come clear. Mother used to be able to take something cloudy and make it clear for herself and for me. I'm just not good enough."
Doro said nothing, stood still, trying to make sense of the strange grasping, the weariness.
"Go to her, damn you!"
Leah screamed, and then more softly,
"Help her.
She's been a healer since she was back in Africa. Now she needs somebody to heal her. Who could do it but you?
He left them and went looking for Anyanwu. He had not thought in terms of healing her before.